Daniel Browning with you. Welcome to Into the Music, music features and documentaries here on RN. Today, we look at one of the most important institutions for English music in the 20th century. It was a place that composers like Holst, Vaughan Williams and Tippett were passionate about. But I'm almost certain you won't have ever heard of it. The place is Morley College. It's one of the oldest institutions to provide evening classes for working class men and women, and it remains a thriving, creative venue for the community of South London. But surprisingly, Morley College was also responsible for the huge revival of early English music at the start of the 20th century, as well as being the only place in London where you could hear new works by living British composers, like this music by Vaughan Williams. RN's Michael Shiriffs studied at Morley in the early 90s, and today, for the college's 125th anniversary, he revisits the place. But first, a writer's comments on Morley College from the late 1950s.
The scene is the surviving wing of a blitzed building, an evening college for adults, in the Westminster Bridge Road. The time, just after 6:30 on an autumn evening in 1956. The cheerful turmoil of the students' arrival is already over, and a scholarly hush, broken only by occasional laughter from the classrooms, the clatter of crockery in the canteen, and the relentless efforts of the choir sopranos to come to grips with a modern work in the Holst room, pervades the corridors. By this time, the sound of the choir is becoming still more insistent, and the principal leads the little group into the Holst room.
Okay, well, look, welcome to Morley College. I'm just going to give you a little bit of a tour of some of the classes that are going on this evening. In the background, you can hear, actually, this is a piano class, and what they're doing is they're practicing the concertos against that wonderful background of orchestra.
I'm Andrea Brown. I'm Director of Music at Morley College.
That's in our Holst room, which is our second largest concert room. Gustav Holst was Director of Music here at Morley College some years ago, and we built this room in commemoration of him. Now we're just going to go into our main music corridor.
Well, Morley College started as an idea, really. Emma Cons, who was a social reformer, wanted to really expand the knowledge and experience of the working men and women of Waterloo. At that time, it was a very shady place to be. Certainly the music halls and the gin houses of that area were not a wonderful place to live and thrive. And so Emma Cons started holding classes in the basement of the Old Vic Theatre. And these were courses in things like cookery, courses in poetry, and indeed in music.
The population of London in this period is exploding. About 4 million people in 1890, and within one decade, say by 1900, it's up to 6.5 million.
Leanne Langley is a social and cultural historian with a particular fascination for the role of Morley College at the start of the 20th century in London.
I think people like Emma Cons realised the connection between drink, working class recreation, and what she had witnessed herself as domestic violence against women. And I think it's very striking that in her case, she committed herself to trying to improve the situation for women by getting rid of drink, or as far as possible, replacing it. Emma's motivation was not, let's be missionaries for art, let's take great art to these poor people so that they can be more content with their lives, or they can broaden their minds. In other words, it wasn't a top-down, I'm going to tell you what's good for you attitude. It was much more, I think she was experimenting to see what people liked. She was experimenting to see, these people have a voice, perhaps they would like to sing or make art or find out what they could do to join in an activity, not just sit and listen passively to somebody talking. She did have concerts. They were ballad concerts. And she did stress drinking coffee or tea instead of alcohol. And the concerts were, I have to say, probably pretty boring. They were ballads mostly, rather than anything more interesting or exciting or new. But the appeal to the notion that any individual coming to these things might have a voice themselves, I think, attracted people.
It was early in 1907, when the tide of musical interest was already rising, that the college found Gustav Holst. Holst was not, in fact, the council's first choice for the post. A year or two beforehand, Ralph Vaughan Williams...
They originally asked Ralph Vaughan Williams, but rather interestingly, he said that he felt he was too busy at the time to accept the work, and so he recommended his friend Mr. von Holst. And the Morley committee weren't sure of Mr. von Holst and so auditioned him by asking him to give a lecture on a musical subject. And so Gustav gave a lecture on the horrors of bagpipe music, and which I believe they were so charmed by that he got the job.
From that single decision has flowed the college's whole subsequent reputation in music.
English music at the beginning of the 20th century was undergoing a great change. It was breaking away from the dominance of German music and wanting to create its own idiom, and it was a very important idiom for them. And the composers who were associated with Morley really were key figures in that movement. But they also had a great deal of respect for working men and women and a great deal of respect for an excellent education. And I think those two elements combined made Morley a pioneering centre for English music making at the beginning of the 20th century.
Rachel Landgren is a researcher at the Melbourne Conservatorium of Music, and recently she spent some time at Morley delving into the college's rich archives and examining the critical role of the music department in the revival of early English music.
English 20th century composers felt that England hadn't had a voice within the music realm since the death of Henry Purcell in 1695. There had never been a composer that stepped in to take his place. Therefore, the dominance of continental music rose. Handel arrived, and then other composers came from time to time. And while London was a hub for music making, it wasn't English music making. And so at the turn of the century, composers like Stamford and Parry really wanted to promote Englishness and an English sound. And to do that, they had to look back, and had to look back quite far. And so this is what fueled a revival in early music and also English folk music.
The music students of Morley College, under the direction of Mr. Gustav von Holst, will give a concert performance of The Faerie Queen by Henry Purcell on Saturday, June 10, 1911 at 8 p.m. in the Royal Victoria Hall, Waterloo Road, SE. This will be the first complete performance of the work since the composer's death in 1695.
The college clearly, clearly benefited from Holst and his own ideals of socialism and music being owned and for the community. It was Holst who did the first revival of Purcell's Faerie Queen, and He didn't use professional players and singers. He got his students, the Morley students, to perform it, as he rather fondly called them, the Morleyites.
All applications for tickets should be made to Miss Sheepshanks, Morley College, Waterloo Road, SE.
And he didn't really stop there. I mean, he had a manuscript of Purcell's Fairy Queen, and he got his students in his harmony class to transcribe the entire thing. So he had his own parts written by Morley students and then performed by Morley students. It's just extraordinary how that sense of ownership that he instilled within his students of music really being for all.
The musical critics of the English press have vied with each other in seeking complimentary adjectives wherewith to describe the Morley College concert performance of The Fairy Queen, which took
from
place
the
on
Times,
Saturday,
Purcell's Fairy Queen. A most interesting and artistic performance of this very important work was given in Victoria Hall, Waterloo Road, by the music students of Morley College under the able direction of Mr. Gustav von Holst on Saturday evening. The accidental recovery of the long-lost original score after more than 200 years in the library of the Royal Academy of Music.
Jonathan Greaves-Smith is chorus master for the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra, but he grew up in an England that had really found its voice through places like Morley College.
I think that it's closest to almost the amateur choral scene in a way, and obviously there were the amateur orchestras as well, but the idea that after work you could in a way have a means of improvement but also to a degree entertainment by going to, join the Huddersfield Choral Society or whatever it happens to be. You know, this was part of also a movement that said we need to look after a group of people who are now out of work, who, because of circumstances that they couldn't have foreseen, need to find work. And the musicians like Vaughan Williams, Holst and Tippett were all people who wanted to teach, liked to teach, liked to be amongst community music making. This was crucial to them. And whether that be the folk music collecting of a lot of the first years of last century, or it's actually getting down and dirty and trying to turn amateur singers into something really presentable, which Tippett certainly did. This was really core importance to these musicians who were also involved at the highest level with the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra or whatever it happens to have been.
If you say Morley College now, people are used to the very high standard of music making that goes on. But they were real beginners in those days.
Gustav Holst's daughter Imogen had strong memories of the world her father had created at Morley.
Some of them couldn't read their notes. He tried to teach them. And some of them really didn't make an awfully nice sound on their instruments. I remember there was one woman who had a paralyzed right arm. And she had to play the violin by leaning against the wall with her paralyzed arm and moving the violin to and fro. But my father put her among other violinists who could play, and so she did very little damage. And of course it was the making of her life.
I think Holst evidently kept his standards high. What I find admirable, because if you've ever tried to conduct amateurs in a group, you do notice it can pull down the aspirational level of what a professional musician might have. But in his case, he never let that happen. He seemed to relish challenging. Tippett did the same thing later. You don't lower your standards just because you're working with amateurs. In fact, it helps sometimes to raise them and continue to give challenges to people who think they might not be able to do something, and then to work with them individually and collectively until everybody succeeds. It's a wonderful, thrilling moment when there's a performance of something that people have worked hard towards.
When I attended Morley College in the early 90s, I wasn't studying music, but printmaking, with one of England's finest master printers as my teacher. I couldn't believe that the man that worked with people like Lucian Freud and Frank Auerbach was teaching me in an evening class. And it was at this time that I learnt stories about the college's music department, and the one that had the most impact on me was about Holst, Vaughan Williams and Tippett encouraging the choir and the orchestra to audition and even premiere many of these composers' new works. I was struck by such trust and, I suppose, lack of ego. But it was Holst that laid the foundations for this sort of creative involvement from amateurs.
Absolutely. And, you know, he would use his Morleyites to transcribe his own parts, as well as the early British madrigalists or the early music that he was so fond of as well, that might just be existing in manuscript. He also enjoyed celebrating his music and others' music through performance, and so he often got his Morleyites and the St. Paul's girls together to perform various works that he might be trying out. So yes, there was very much that sense of let's try something, let's have a go, which I think was really celebrated.
I think there's a mixture of selfishness and altruism in the whole thing. I think they knew that they could workshop, if you like, their latest symphony, their latest piece, whatever, in that situation without incurring costs. And that's, you know, on the really cynical side. But on the other, they really believed that, you know, music belonged to everybody. It wasn't just for king, but it was also for commoner. And above anything else, they wanted people to be doing it, not listening to it.
There was a great deal of new composition premiered at Morley or simply just performed by the Morley students. I know that Vaughan Williams' Mass in G minor was performed by the Morley Choir on a number of occasions. I'm not sure if they premiered it, but they definitely performed it at Morley and a few other places in London and at Holst's own festival. Holst's very beautiful four songs for voice and violin were inspired when Holst happened upon a Morley student singing in church to the accompaniment of her own violin, and he set about composing these songs, which were premiered by Morley students before being taken up by more successful sopranos of the day.
How did the formal music establishment see this? I mean, the Royal Academy and the Royal College, Morley was doing something that they either couldn't or wouldn't do in terms of the revival of early English music and also of bringing in very, very contemporary, quite sort of avant-garde works.
I think there was quite a lot of sneering in truth. I mean, I think that, you know, they saw, you know, good on them, you know, good amateurs doing their best down there. You know, the performances probably were, you know, a mixture of average to okay compared to, you know, obviously students who were going to head into the major orchestras. But in the end, because somebody like Tippett was there, because Holst was there, there had to be this respect because these were people who were being played by students at the Royal Academy. These weren't, you know, some sort of, you know, people who didn't quite make it in the profession and who decided to conduct the amateurs, you know. These were serious musicians, and I think the respect was inevitable.
It did have a significant place within the musical establishment of London, simply because of how the press talked about it and the types of concerts, the types of performances that were happening at the time, and also for the people who taught there. So there would be people who might be attending conservatoire, who also might do a course at Morley College because Gustav Holst taught composition there, or indeed later on Michael Tippett, or indeed later on Cornelius Cardew. So it's always had a very special place in the musical establishment of London, and it's still very highly regarded.
The liberty and the freedom that actually Morley had and could enjoy was something that certainly couldn't be enjoyed, the academy or wherever, where, you know, the job was to turn out phenomenal musicians, who put the right things first. Morley was a questioning culture. Its background was rather left of centre way of thinking, which couldn't be said of the academy, and they wanted to discover this new music. There was time to research, to develop, to use the energy of people. It is, if you like, rather that gorgeous difference. And it's not to put one above the other, but the difference between, say, an amateur choir, talking from my background, and a professional choir, that amateur choir will go places and do things that professionals say, well, you're not going to pay me for those hours. We actually know how to do those things. You don't need to spend extra rehearsals on it. You know, they actually at Morley had this time to investigate Monteverdi, to put together scores, to learn in a depth that wasn't time for, wasn't profiled high enough at a place like the Royal College. Because it always had this, great questioning spirit around it, and this endeavour of discovery, that was something where the latest thing coming in was just excitement. I mean, they talk about Holst arriving at rehearsals at Morley, and he didn't have, the latest harmony treatise or something with him. He had Stravinsky's Petrushka, for instance, and he was bringing the latest in. So there was that excitement the whole time. It wasn't stuck in the past. You know, in truth, the conservatoires in England in general went through a parochialism and a conservatism that was a big frustration. They got left behind, not in quality of playing, but in terms of repertoire. And I think it's only, in recent years, and obviously great advocates like Simon Rattle, but there were others, London Sinfonietta and what have you, who actually sort of dragged it back and said, this is crucial. We've got to be musicians of today as well as of yesterday.
Gustav Holst remained as the director of music at Morley until 1924, a tenure of 17 incredibly influential years for the college, and an influence that extended to English music in general, with one of the most significant works of the early 20th century, The Planet Suite, being written in collaboration with his students at both Morley and at St Paul's Girls' School in Hammersmith. This is an excerpt from Tony Palmer's film called Holst in the Bleak Midwinter.
Holst always wrote directly for the orchestra, not piano first, then orchestrate later. But because of his crippling neuritis, he actually had a pen strapped to his middle finger to enable him to write at all. He had two young ladies from the school, Nora Day and Vally Lasker, waiting at the other end of the room, as it were. As soon as a page of the score was finished, they would quickly make a piano reduction and try bits out for him, so that he could hear what he had written. I found the actual score here in a cupboard a few years back, and so The Planets was in fact first performed in this room. Four hands, one piano.
Planets had no precedent in English music, and it finally established Holst as a great innovator. But the work also reflected the terrible period of the First World War that had cost so many lives. It had gutted the population of Morley College, and Holst, like so many artists, sublimated the horror into his music. Gustav Holst stepped down from the position at Morley in 1924, but his successors, Arnold Goldsborough and Arnold Foster, maintained the ethic and intent of their predecessor. And it was during Arnold Foster's reign that a young Michael Tippett conducted a performance at Morley College by the South London Orchestra for Unemployed Musicians. It was 1933, and Hitler had just become Chancellor of Germany. 7 years later, less than a year after Europe had descended back into war, and barely a week after Morley was bombed in the Blitz, Tippett began as the college's new director of music.
That's right, Morley College did get hit rather badly during the Blitz. And there's a very funny story that, because of course all of the music was stored on site as well as the library books, everything. And there's a funny story of Tippett kind of dodging, as soon as after the college has been hit, of Tippett dodging in and out of the wreckage, trying to save various scores of Holst and other composers from burning. But yes, it was a tough start for Tippett, absolutely.
Composer Alexander Gurr was a close friend of Tippett, and he recalls that moment soon after the bombing of the college.
I remember him with his rucksack arriving at Victoria Station. I think he was living at Waterhouse then, I'm not quite sure. And I remember going with him to what remained of Morley College after the bombs had hit it, which was the Holst room, one or two other rooms, and the canteen, and the whole flavour of those years is very much connected in my mind with Tippett, because that particular mixture of political and social activity, political and socialist activity, mixed with a very wide-ranging interest in all kinds of arts and branches of knowledge was very characteristic of that building, Morley College, at that time, and very much summed up in the activities of Michael Tippett.
One of Michael Tippett's remarkable achievements was to get a choir up and running, albeit a small one, within only a week or two of the bombing. However, the orchestra was a different matter.
During the wartime sessions which followed, Tippett was never able to rebuild more than a very small college orchestra, and the South London Orchestra dispersed entirely. But by the beginning of the 1941 to 1942 session, he had built up the choir to an effective unit of some 30 voices, and by 1944-1945, it was again at a strength of over 70. The bomb thus caused only the briefest interruption to the musical activity of the college. Within a few months, the orchestra apart, Tippett had restored it to the standards which Holst had introduced and Goldsborough and Foster maintained.
And this is one of the only recordings of Michael Tippett conducting the Morley Choir as they perform Thomas Tallis's Spem in Alium.
There were nationally funded organizations for taking art and particularly theatre out into the community because it was seen as morale booster. And the same thing happened at the proms, discussions of shall we stop music or shall we play more music. And it was always seen as something to keep people happy, keep people going. But Tippett didn't bow to this idea of you've got to just play happy tunes to keep people working, or you've got to put on music while you work with whistling and all that sort of stuff. He was providing a strong intellectual reason for people to keep involved, which is, you know, get your mind active, keep focusing on this. This is important. And at the same time, he's struggling himself with some terrific personal issues in his private life, but also in his attitude to war and to what he owed in terms of going to prison for a belief. He could have got out of that. I'm sure he could have, but he didn't. He went to prison, and he sort of paid his dues in that respect. He himself wanted people to see that he was a part of this community, not above it. I think that's remarkable.
As soon as the war appeared on the horizon, I came back to the base ground from which I think all pacifism must eventually stem, that for some people, they are forced by the necessities of their makeup to feel that the ends could never decide the means. That's to say that good ends could never sort of make up for bad means. Now, this is so deep to me that I feel all ideological wars, really, you have to be certain that the other people are so horrible that it is you discharge upon this other side, you know, the sort of bad things, if you like, in yourself. And now, once you've got that, then it is your moral duty, people feel, to do the things that are necessary to remove them as a kind of cancer. Let me get it quite clear. When this last war happened, and a colleague of mine, Alan Rawson, now dead, who is exactly my own age, went to the war, I'm sure he went with as clear a moral conviction as I went to prison.
Another impact of war that both Holst and Tippett had to deal with was the loss of male voices. And for a defiant music director in a London under siege, to keep going meant being adaptable with arrangements for the predominantly female choirs.
Yes, I think that's the sign of a real creator who takes the local situation and enhances it, uses it to enhance his own work, in a sense. It can be considered a strategic move, you know, a smart thing to do.
What's interesting, I think, about Morley is that it was founded by a woman. And there have always been female leadership, female role models throughout Morley's history. I mean, our current principal is a woman. It's very topical at the moment because of this year being the first year that a woman has conducted the last night of the proms. By that I mean Maren Allsop. And so it's interesting that there still can be firsts for women. And we have decided that we're going to run a course for female conductors, and it's been supported by the Royal Academy of Music and Opera House and a couple of other partners. And that's, I'm hoping, going to start to readdress the imbalance of through education and through education to young women. And I think at the moment, Morley's the only place that would be possible to run such a course.
One of Tippett's most important works, one that has great significance for the Morley College Music Department, is A Child of Our Time, a work that Tippett started writing on the first day of the war. Jonathan Greaves Smith worked with Michael Tippett on one of the performances of the work and believes the depth of the composer's convictions about peace and social justice defines so much of how and where he chose to work.
A I think Tippett going to Morley was an inevitable and beautiful choice. I mean, the man was ebullience itself, and he was committed to grassroots work. He'd been involved for many years with amateur musicians. He was ambitious for his own music, but he was ambitious in discovering other music. And I think his left of center views, and you know, he was communist in, you know, in certain periods of his life, and very left leaning, very concerned for social welfare, you know, fitted in Morley, where the thought of him, you know, being director of music at the Royal College of Music, you know, they would have shuddered.
When he was employed in 1940 to 51, that period itself just soared, partly because, as a result of his insistence that he be able to hire some wonderful musicians from Europe who were fleeing Nazi persecution. Walter Gurr was one, and of course Matthias Seiber, against, I think, the wishes possibly of von Williams, who thought, really, we ought to keep this in English operation. But he got the support of the Morley principal, Eva Lubbock, and I think that was a great motivation to continue to let Morley be an outward-facing organization. This is very important in wartime, obviously.
Sue Cole is a musicologist at the Melbourne Conservatorium of Music and a specialist on the work of Michael Tippett.
I think one of the main things that Tippett got out of Morley was that there were just an extraordinary group of people who were working there. Because it was in that little bit outside the mainstream, because they were prepared to be a little bit adventurous, I think they employed a lot of really, really good musicians and musicologists who'd come to England from Europe because of the war. They had Jewish composers, musicologists, other people who just decided that Germany wasn't where they wanted to be anymore. So they had a group of people like Hans Redlich and Walter Bergman and Walter Gurr and Matthias Seiber, good people. And Walter Bergman actually knew a great deal more about early music than Tippett did. And that what Tippett had was, he obviously was the kind of person who could bring people together, get them excited about something, let them do what they were good at, and make things happen. And it's an extraordinary kind of achievement, and possibly not so possible in a more normal, structured educational institution. It could be very free-floating. You meet someone who plays continuo for you and you discover he's interested in teaching recorder, and so next thing you know, he's there teaching recorder classes at Morley. And not everyone was teaching recorder classes in the 1940s. So Walter Bergman had a very big role in bringing recorder and sort of early music recorder, Telemann and those kinds of composers to England through Morley. So I think there was a sort of a freedom to just have people doing what they wanted to do that maybe wasn't available at other places.
In fact, some commentators have speculated that the rapid rise in the interest in early instruments in England that we now take for granted was partly a product of Morley's unrestrained and unorthodox curiosity.
The increasing concern for the arts among intelligent men and women of modest means was seen perhaps most clearly in the realm of music. A decade and a half of missionary work by the BBC had had its effect, and by 1939 the level of musical taste and appreciation among the general public was steadily rising. With the outbreak of war and the later bombing, this valuable gain was inevitably jeopardized. Certain artists, however, and foremost among them Myra Hess, with her lunchtime concerts at the National Gallery, remained determined to sustain music lovers in the capital, bombs or no bombs. In this matter of providing the London public with good music amid the exigencies of war, the Morley College Music Department under Michael Tippett bore an honourable and by no means insubstantial share.
there were terrific contingencies right across London, not only because of bombing, but because of people's fear and doubt about what was happening. And I think it did become a kind of an alternative center for music making. I mean, everyone will have heard of, say, the Myra Hess chamber concerts at the National Gallery, which was a great morale booster for central London and for people who were normally used to going to concerts. She played, of course, international repertory. In the face of German bombs flying, she was still playing, of course, Beethoven. But the new music that was coming out at Morley would have attracted attention for that very reason. Now, there wouldn't have been flocks and flocks of people going to the concerts there, but he did maintain the principle. He maintained the notion that amateur performers and players are committed to doing this, and it builds the community. It's cohesive for those who want to be involved. My sense is, by the 1940s, and particularly looking back from 51 after Tippett left, I think it was obvious later that this was the hub, really, of contemporary music in London. You've got to consider that the only other alternative might have been the BBC Orchestra, who was always at the cutting edge right from the 1930 when it was founded.
I think Tippett, in my experience, he was this gorgeous, energetic, loving, entertaining, almost childlike man, you know, quite self-regarding in some ways, but with a sort of innocence that made you not worry about that. And the performances of Child of Our Time with him there, for me, are one of the great treasured memories. I have to say that at the end of the concert of the Child of Our Time, it's the last one, I think, Chorus Masters with him, he stood up and ran down the steps in the festival hall. And he only had peripheral vision by this stage. And the steps are quite wide. And I have to say, anybody who knew him was just waiting for this terrible moment in which he'd actually collapsed forward. But of course, he ran onto the platform, kissed everybody that he could find. And there was a feeling that this piece, in Child of Our Time, retained a huge importance politically as well as musically. And it is a staging post in English music.
In the post-war years, Morley College had to adapt to a rapidly changing London, but the privations of war persisted for a long time. Michael Graubart, who had arrived in London as a young boy escaping Kristallnacht in 1938, became music director in 1969, a position he held for the next 22 years. Through all that time, South London remained very much the poor side of the river.
Morley really did start introducing people who had really not had any good education at all, people who needed help with things like literacy and computer skills and all sorts of things in order to get jobs. So Morley did become a very important factor in the social life and the integration of immigrants, of all sorts of people, into society and into productive life.
So really went back to its roots in a London that was very different to those early years of Emma Kohns and Gustav Holst.
Absolutely. Back to its roots while also still trying to sustain the more advanced and more esoteric, if you like, work at the same time. And I think from the musical point of view, Morley did do great things, I must say. We did the first staged public performances of Victor Ullmann's opera that was written in the concentration camp of Terezin, the Emperor of Atlantis. We gave first performances of chamber music by all sorts of composers. So that continued as best we could. But at the same time, We had, you know, classes in drumming, in Irish, traditional drumming for the Irish population of London, and classes in reggae, and that was going on at the same time as classes in literacy and numeracy and computer skills, in all sorts of things that were useful to people that hadn't had a good education.
Who are your constituents now? Who are the people that are drawn to you and naturally feel at home in a place like Morley?
What's exciting about Morley College is that there probably are about 150 different languages spoken. And that's quite reflective of the borough in which we find ourselves, which is Lambeth. And so while we can talk about the courses that we offer in music, we also have a very thriving skills department, and languages, visual arts, dance, health, humanities. So I would say actually we are quite a diverse community.
As the current music director, Andrea Brown has taken the issue of modern relevance very seriously, embarking on a year-long project called A Choir of Our Time. Andrea assembled a massive combined choir from across South London to perform alongside the London Philharmonic Orchestra Sir Michael Tippett's A Child of Our Time at the Royal Festival Hall.
We really just wanted to engage more with the different types of choirs that existed in Lambeth and Southwark. Choral singing is a huge tradition in Britain, and it became very evident to me that actually there were huge amounts of choirs who weren't necessarily getting very much opportunity to perform, or indeed had much knowledge of each other. So really the project was first and foremost to engage with the local choirs in the Lambeth and Southwark communities, but to also celebrate the work of A Child of Our Time. It's a fantastic piece, particularly because he wrote it along the same lines as the oratorios of Bach and Handel. And so there are moments during this piece where the people come together. And in Bach and Handel, these are examples of the Lutheran chorales, for instance, of Bach. Now, Tippett decided to use spirituals instead as moments of reflection, of coming together. And these are placed throughout this grand work. And we use these spirituals as the opportunities for these different choirs to perform with us. So it was performed at the Royal Festival Hall with the BBC singers, who were the soloists, and in fact they were partners throughout the project. We ran special workshops with them and invited all the choirs to come and sing with the BBC singers throughout the year. And the orchestra was the London Philharmonic Orchestra, who were very impressed by the project. So it was a real triumph, because on the one hand it was celebrating at a very high level a work by Tippett, which was composed at Morley, but also it was celebrating the coming together and performing together. And these choirs are now talking to each other. These choirs are now working on what the next performance is going to be like.
The sound when you have so many voices singing in unison is fantastic. It's been really good. Met so many incredible people from all walks of life, and just being part of something that's beautiful music as well.
I've always loved singing, so this was an opportunity to sing in a more professional way. You've got some very good pointers on how to sing and how to express yourself while you're singing.
It's just amazing. It, you know, the sound, you know, it really resonates. So sounds great to me.
Well, slightly nervous. The first time singing such a huge choir, so I am a bit nervous.
People went to Morley because they had questions, because they wanted to discover that it wasn't clear what they were going to end up with or whether it necessarily they'd end up being practicing musician. It was part of being a bigger human being. And I think that is its biggest compliment any of us can give to it. You know, it made people bigger and better. And those who chose to make it professional, fantastic. But for those who did something else, it informed their life. It's something they never forgot and which made them richer and probably gave them the opportunity to give in a much richer way.
The culmination of a lot of work by the Morley College Music Department, with their performance of Tippett's Child of Our Time at the Royal Festival Hall in London. Michael Shiriffs produced that program. The sound engineer was Matthew Crawford. For more information about Morley College, as well as Michael's guests and the music you heard throughout the program, just visit Into the Music's website, where you'll also find some wonderful archival images of Morley and where you can listen again online to this program, or download some other Into the Music features. Next week, Drawing Towards Music with composer Edward Cowie, who was a student at Morley College too in the mid-60s. He's made a program about the strong links between visual art and composition, a subject quite close to his arts practice, as we'll find out next week here on Into the Music. Here's a snippet.
Trees of all kinds in the distance look like musical notes. And, yes, I'm thinking of this stunning pointillist J.S. Bach prelude when I look at those paintings. So, Kandinsky knew and demonstrated the potency of points as foundation forms in all of the arts and in nature itself. But he also knew that nothing stays fixed for long and that all things move and change. Nature and art are impregnated by time. Human beings never perceive things without movement, without shifting position to get a different perspective on something. Time and perception are inextricable. So, in the next stage of his treatise in Point and Line to Plane, Kandinsky applies the loaded brush and moves it away from the point of impact. How different the sound is between making a point and making a line.
Edward Cowie with his theories about points, lines and planes and music here on Into the Music next week. I'm Daniel Browning. I look forward to your company then.